Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And while the longest U.S. government shutdown, now at 31 days, highlights the dysfunction of our political system, overseas, one of our biggest allies, Britain, is facing down a similar political crisis with Brexit. As the New York Times reports today, a plan B for Brexit came from Theresa May yesterday, and it looks a lot like the defeated plan A. Now, by law, the United Kingdom must pull out of the European Union on March 29th, but the biggest marketplace for British goods is barreling toward an abrupt disruption with or without any plan, withdrawal from the EU. We read would impact over $700 billion in trade for the United Kingdom if you combine imports and exports. Of course, this could spell pain for British people as well as possibly others. So here to untangle the latest Brexit news and discuss what it means for Americans are Stephen Castle, who is the London correspondent for The Times, and Amy Davidson Sorkin from The New Yorker. Maybe you saw her piece the other day, Can an American Get Excited About Brexit? A six-part test. And that test includes the questions, do you have fears about or hopes for populism in America? And do you have a penchant for dystopian scenarios? So, Amy, despite that question, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Castle, welcome.
Well, thank you.
How is Theresa May's new plan B a lot like the defeated plan A?
It's almost exactly like plan A, in fact. And I think that's really the latest development in this crisis, though. We're now going to go through a protracted period of brinksmanship here in Britain with a dispute essentially now between Theresa May trying to push this plan again, maybe getting some changes from the European Union first, but lawmakers in Parliament trying to wrest control and actually take those decisions out of her hands. So we're in for a very difficult 2 or 3 weeks here.
And remind our American listeners what's at stake if there is no deal by March 29th?
Well, if there's no deal by March 29th, in theory, Britain leaves the European Union. And that could mean something really catastrophic if you take into account some of the worst-case predictions. It could mean clogged ports. It could mean food running out in supermarkets. It could mean supplies of drugs running low. In my view, that is very unlikely to happen because the one thing that there is a clear majority in the British Parliament for is to stop that scenario of no deal. I don't think Theresa May wants it. I certainly don't think the European Union wants it. The question is how to stop it and whether there'll be an agreement before that date.
And Amy, one of the things that I guess is a dystopian scenario under a no deal is your item number one on Can an American Get Excited About Brexit, a six-part test. Test question number one is, do you care about Ireland? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I think this is the one point that a lot of Americans, it's going to push a lot of emotional buttons for Americans, which is the way the Irish question has been dealt with in the entire Brexit debate by all sides, which is without a lot of care and with a lot of heedlessness towards the real accomplishments of the peace process in Ireland. I mean, you've got a basic problem. Brexit, if it means anything, means some sort of much harder border between Britain and the European Union. The Republic of Ireland is in the European Union. Northern Ireland is in Britain. So it means, in some ways, a border between them. The problem is that in 1998, Britain was a party to the Good Friday Agreement, which ended the troubles in Ireland and relies on there not being a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which are the counties that are part of the United Kingdom. So in other words, Brexit is in contradiction with the Good Friday peace accords, and it's frustrating for I think any anybody. America was helped broker those peace accords as a real accomplishment, but also a lot of Americans do have strong feelings about the Irish question about peace and see it as a real victory that risks being thrown away. And neither side has really, really come up with a solution to this. Theresa May's government's plan has their deal with Europe basically puts off the question for 2 years, but includes something called the backstop, which is basically an insurance policy, which means if they can't figure out the Irish border, Britain basically stays kind of in the European Union. That's why her plan got voted down. The Brexit question right now is an Ireland question, and there's been in some parties, especially in the hard Brexit parties, there's been a kind of contempt for the concerns of the Irish or dismissiveness about it that I think it's not only a political thing, but it's, I think, for a lot of Americans could be an emotional aspect to all of this.
And maybe we can pinpoint a listener call-in question on this. We can take any call on Brexit for our guests, Amy Davidson Sorkin from The New Yorker and Stephen Castle, London correspondent for The New York Times, who is over there, 212-433-WNYC. But how about any Irish people or Irish Americans who have an emotional or political or any other investment here 20 years on after that historic peace agreement in 1998, anticipating the possibility that the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland could get closed again. What do you hope? What do you fear? What do you think the solution might be? People with connection to Ireland, two listeners, 212. Let me just finish inviting people in. The phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Go ahead, Amy.
To Stephen's point, I think nobody wants no deal, but the people who don't want no deal all want different things. Some of them want a second referendum. Some of them want a hard, reasonably hard Brexit. Some of them want a soft Brexit. They're not agreeing. So there's not the risks of miscalculation leading to a no deal Brexit are pretty high because something has to be done to prevent a no deal exit, and the British seem to be having a hard time with that.
Stephen, let me play a clip of Theresa May and then get you to talk about it, because probably a lot of our listeners are rooting for one of the options that Amy just listed, which is a second referendum, a do-over on Brexit, and maybe they'll just vote it down and say, nah, on second thought, I don't think so. But here's what the Prime Minister had to say about that.
I do not believe there is a majority for a second referendum. And if I am right, then just as the government is having to think again about its approach going forwards, then so too do those members who believe this is the answer. So I will be talking further this week to colleagues, including in the DUP, to consider how we might meet our obligations to the people of Northern Ireland and Ireland in a way that can command the greatest possible support in the House. And I will then take the conclusions of those discussions back to the EU.
You know, Stephen, a lot of people say if we just ran the 2016 presidential election in this country again, even a few months after that election, it would have come out the opposite. Do you think the same is true about Brexit?
It's not really clear. I mean, I think it might well do, but I think there is a problem, which is that this referendum took place. And I think a lot of people would feel rather let down, and supporters of Brexit might feel a little betrayed if that referendum were rerun. Having said that, I think if we are in a logjam at the end of the month, which it looks as if we still might be, if there's still continuing stalemate, then I think creative solutions will have to be found. At present, I don't think there is a majority in Parliament to have a second referendum, and of course you would need a majority in Parliament to legislate for it. But if there is a logjam and there's still gridlock at the end of the month, then I think all sorts of things might become possible. One of those is a general election. The other is a referendum. So I don't think it's off the table at all.
Nigel in Flatbush. And Amy, we'll get back to you in a second. Nigel in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nigel.
So, look at this. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
The two kings of democracy on planet Earth are disemboweling themselves from within. All right? Trump wants a wall, and now we can have a wall between Ulster and freaking Republic of Ireland, right? Is what they want this to be done. This isn't going to happen. I smell the Ruskies all over this. The Ruskies implemented Trump. Perhaps the Ruskies put Miss May in to get this whole, you know, the craziness going.
Nigel, I'm going to leave it there partly because your line is very noisy. Stephen, I'm going to go to you on this first. He says the Ruskies, but, you know, despite that sort of slur, Putin's fingerprints are a little bit on Brexit, like they are to whatever degree on Trump, right?
There have been a series of questions about possible Russian funding of the referendum campaign in 2016, although I have to say that nothing has really come up there that would really change the debate in Britain. I would just point out, in terms of what is suggested or what is likely to happen in Ireland, we're not really talking about a war. We're certainly not talking about a war. We're not, at the moment, talking about any big frontier infrastructure. The issue is goods, the transit of goods, and whether they would have to be checked. Now, the problem in Northern Ireland is that, of course, this is a very sensitive border. It was the focus of the conflict and the troubles that caused deaths in the 1970s and the 1980s. And therefore, the worry is that if there were, for example, physical signs of checks, that might become a source of tension and a course of conflict again at that frontier, and that's something that nobody wants. But there is no proposal for a wall. It's how you ensure that goods can flow across this border without any checks, when, in fact, the two territories would be in completely different economic entities.
Amy, did you want to get in on this or the previous point?
Well, you know, just about the referendum, it seems that one problem is what the question would be if there was a new referendum. Like, would it be Brexit or no Brexit? Would it be Theresa May's plan for Brexit or no deal Brexit? So there's not even quite agreement on that. I think one thing that's interesting is that the frustrations of the Europeans are that they just can't get a straight answer from the British on what Parliament would pass, what they actually, you know, this morning one of the EU officials was quoting the Spice Girls and saying, you know, tell us what you want, what you really, really want. And it's really unclear. I mean, there's a lot of we don't want this, we don't want this, we don't want this. There's not a real clear plan. But, you know, one of the other groups that's angry within Britain is the Scottish, who had their own referendum on independence that was premised on, you know, a vote to stay with Britain is a vote to stay in the EU. And that's sort of been pulled away. So that's mm-hmm. you know, one question is if Brexit does go through, is there then another drive for a Scottish independence referendum. So there are a lot of balls in play here.
Amy, the caller was making the point that there's a parallel between Donald Trump's wall with Mexico and the British Conservatives' wall with the rest of Europe. And one of the points in your six-point article is, do you have fears about or hopes for populism in America? How would you tie the Brexit situation to the U.S. situation?
With one phrase, what happens, you know, when dreams fail? You know, the idea that in with Brexit that there was something that was promised, and if it doesn't work out, are people going to feel not that they were wrong to vote for Brexit, but that their dream of this thing that they voted for and wanted was somehow betrayed or undermined by politicians who just said it was too hard? It's kind of the parallel of Trump's voters thinking that he's being, you know, undermined by the deep state. So what happens to that populist dream? Do they say, you know, really, I should have been more sensible from the start and loved the European Union or voted for Hillary? Or do they say that, you know, we tried with electoral politics and we're going to become even more alienated now? That's the real, you know, and May has talked about that. Do you just tell people that their referendum didn't count, people who didn't vote for years before the referendum, who maybe never voted before. How do you both kind of get it right and respect mm-hmm. the idea of the democratic yeah. process and it's... not show just disdain for people who might have real problems in their lives,
yeah.
real grievances. Yeah,
it's such a fundamental question. Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. It's very interesting, and I'm sure it could go on much longer than the time you can allocate to it. But there's a couple of points I would like to make. I'm Irish. I did live in England for 9 years. My wife is English. While living there, there was something I became very much aware of in the 70s and 80s, and that is that many of the older generation, if you like, still think of England as being an empire. And I think this may have been borne out in the voting to leave. If you look at the voting patterns, older people voted to leave. I think younger people voted to remain. However, there was a lady called Patel, who was a minister in Theresa May's government until, I believe, December 2017. When Theresa May encountered problems with the vote, in December, only about 4 weeks ago, this Miss Patel suggested that the English government should stop food imports or exports from England into Ireland by way of increasing pressure on the Irish government to step back from the entire backstop deal, or that portion of the deal.
Amy, go ahead, please.
I would just correct that slightly. What she did, and I mentioned this in my post, was she pointed to some experts' report saying that there might be food shortages in the Republic of Ireland and other sorts of shortages as a result of, a note of Brexit that wasn't along the lines that Britain wanted. And she asked why this hadn't been used as a point of pressure in negotiation. Why, in effect, not that England would cause food shortages, but why, in effect, Ireland hadn't been threatened with the prospect of food shortages in negotiations. And it was a shocking, shocking quote, I think, and quite upset a lot of people. And I think that there's in terms of what you're saying about the older view, I'm not sure that everybody in Britain quite realizes how well Ireland has done in the EU. This idea that the Republic of Ireland is so dependent on Britain that it's going to have to give in negotiations doesn't quite express the current reality. Mm-hmm. And I think also the loyalty the rest of the EU feels to the Republic of Ireland, which after all is a member in good standing.
Let's take another Irish call. Geraldine in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Stephen Castle, New York Times, London correspondent, and Amy Davidson Sorkin from The New Yorker. Hi, Geraldine.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to say that Theresa May is being given power by the DUP in Northern Ireland, who are a very, very, very difficult group to deal with. Arlene Foster is the leader. She's not the leader for very long, just for 3 years, but they are deeply committed to never having a united Ireland. And this backstop agreement, they will never agree with it, ever. She is being held in power by them, and if they bail, she loses power. They could give power to the Labour Party just to go against her.
Let me get Stephen on this. Stephen, I think Geraldine is suggesting that there could that there's a hardline party in Northern Ireland that would just as soon kind of go back to the old days, and this process is empowering them. What do you think?
Well, I think clearly the fact that Theresa May doesn't have a majority in Parliament is a big complication for her, and she is reliant on the Democratic Unionist Party. However, one thing that they don't want is Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, in power. That's because they have bad history with him. He was seen as being sympathetic to Sinn Féin in the days when it was linked with the IRA. And therefore, it's quite difficult to see the DUP, in fact, pulling the plug on Theresa May. I think just going back to the earlier point that was made, one of the most negative aspects of this process is how it's injected strain into the relationship between the British and Irish government. And in the last 20 years, that relationship has been excellent. It really has been very, very good. And that's partly because the two governments worked together on the peace process and worked together incredibly effectively. But it's also because they became partners in the European Union, and they worked together on a lot of issues, really saw eye to eye on most economic issues, for example. And Brexit has introduced an acute strain into that relationship, and that's a very negative element, I think, of Brexit.
I would even say it was a tragic aspect of Brexit.
Let's take one more call. Stephen Forest Hill is an importer and exporter.
Yes, let me speak for the international importer and exporter here, and speak to the idiot that talked about the Russians and the Irish. Look, before there was a European Union, the United States did business in England and Europe very well. After there was a European Union, the United States has done business and so forth, but with more problems for the international trader and import-exporter. As far as I'm concerned, if this passed, the people of England voted, they want it down, our business in Europe will continue. There may be more higher prices, but overall business will continue. As far as the European Union is concerned, too many problems, too many rules, too many situations that have helped this situation. And the British have seen this over the period of time. I've heard it from millions of people, hundreds of people. Too much, they want it. Independence. I see nothing wrong with it for England. England will survive, and Europe will survive. That's it.
Steve, thank you very much. Let me get you both on that, and then we're going to be out of time. Stephen, you first, since you're London correspondent.
I think, of course, England and Britain, indeed, will survive. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the question for Britain, though, really is where it sees its future, because it's clearly a global, has global aspirations. But
to his more specific,
somebody's import.
To his more specific question, as an importer and exporter who says business will go forth either way, and the EU had too many rules, is that reflected in the rebellion against the EU? And what about from a business standpoint?
I think it is, but from a business stand, if you're a British exporter, and Britain's a big economy, but it isn't an economy like the US, and therefore, if you're an exporter, you're probably going to have to meet somebody else's export standards. They're either going to have to be the US, or they're going to have to be the EU in most cases. And therefore, Britain then has to decide how close a relationship it wants with the EU, which is, of course, its biggest market. So it's not in that strong a position.
Amy, a last word on any of it.
This might just be why it's also really interesting and to watch. It's going to be, it might be a wild ride where a lot of really new forms are figured out and a lot is improvised at the last minute, and we'll have to see how it happens. But it's not clear, and it's not dull right now.
Stephen Castle's article in the New York Times, Plan B for Brexit looks a lot like the defeated Plan A. Amy Davison Sorkin's post on the New Yorker site, Can an American get excited about Brexit? A six-part test. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come in 90 seconds.